This is June 11, 1991. Gabrielle Denman and
David
Kranz. This is tape 3, side 1, Oral History, National Council of Jewish Women. We are again at the Anathan House on Murray Avenue. Okay, David, we have a few things to clean up. We've listened to tapes and there are a few gaps. Number one, did your grandparents come directly to Pittsburgh, or where did they come to when they came from?
To my knowledge, they came to New York City and probably were there a very short time, and then came to Pittsburgh where they had, I guess, family, Lunsmen, whatever they were called, and who took care of them. But they came through Ellis Island.
Okay, they did come through Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, the next question I want to know is, do you know what year your family moved from Lawrenceville to Stanton Heights?
It was during World War II, and I was in the service, and I would suspect it had to be the fall of 43 or the spring of 44, probably the end of 43.
Okay. And you mentioned about the shul and Saturday morning mm-hmm. service. Were there any Friday evening service?
No. They used the Butler Street Synagogue, which was its official name, I found out, mostly on Saturday mornings and on holidays, major Jewish holidays. And when the congregation was not at its peak, they actually had the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur holidays there, too. When the congregation swelled, for what reason, I don't know, they would go and rent a hall to do it, which was nicer, because I can remember when it was held, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur was held at that little backyard synagogue. There were taunts and jeers and kids outside doing rock throwing and thing. It wasn't too comfortable. In the hall, when they would go down to, I think it was a hall that was above a bank, somewhere around 43rd Street or 44th Street in Butler, it was a little more convenient in the sense that you were on the second floor.
I see. Okay. you talked quite a bit about your father and a little bit about your mother. Do you have anything else to tell us about your mother?
Well, about my mother, I can tell you that unlike my father, she had a limited formal education, but was very intelligent and a quick learner, and probably in many ways was much more worldly than my father, who had a college degree. My mother worked for many years with her father, and among the places was around 34th and Butler Street, where my grandfather on my mother's side had a grocery store. And during the course of the years she worked there, my mother could speak Croatian, Polish, Yiddish, Serbian, almost all the languages of the ethnic groups that used the store. So when my father in latter years had the store up on Poplar Street, the jewelry store, she still conversed many times with people who came into the store in a limited way. She wasn't that fluent, but she could do it. And she was a very good saleswoman in the store. She worked with my dad all the time. I don't know if this has come up before, but it sort of reflects the Depression years. My father, having been in the jewelry business and optometry business from approximately 1916 to somewhere in the early 30s, business got very bad. And my mother then decided that she would take the store over, and we converted all the jewelry cases to dress cases. And my mother was in the dress business for a few years, and I would go with them down to Fifth Avenue on Sundays to various places like Siner and Kolker.
Siner and Kolker.
And Bagrin on Penn Avenue and a few other places. And they would buy dresses and take them back. And then my father kept his optometric office in the back of the dress shop and kept that going. And I can't tell you how many years we were in the dress business, but I would imagine it was about 3 or 4. And then when things got a little bit better in the late 30s, they converted everything back to the jewelry business. But during those years, my mother was a very good saleswoman. in the jewelry business, she had a great technique of always wearing good-looking watches and rings and selling them off her hand and arm to a customer with a tear in her eye, and then the minute they leave, she'd get another one.
I love it.
But she was good at that.
Wonderful. You did mention that during the Depression, your mother brought apple butter to school.
To the school.
Which is
we were a little bit better off than the others. Yeah. Although I won't say we were well off. We certainly always ate well, and we did have a car, which we kept at a public garage, I remember.
Your mother do any organized charitable work?
No, because she really was in the business with my father. She was quite busy, and she worked the business every day of her life. And I think she enjoyed it, but after all, we lived right with the store, so she could go back into the house and do some cleaning or cooking or whatever she had to do. We were, we sort of ate a very limited menu, I remember, which I'm very thankful for, but we were big cheese eaters and big tuna fish eaters and big omelets and big egg salads and maybe had meat once a week or twice a week, because we would have to go to get the kosher meat. We would have to go to Fifth Avenue or Logan Street on Thursday nights as a family and did the shopping. So we would have meat maybe Friday, and a chicken maybe Friday, and maybe a meat on Sunday. And that was it. And the rest of the week we had no, we ate very vegetarian-ish.
So she did keep a kosher home?
Mm-hmm, my mother did, yes, totally.
Do you want to tell us anything else about your sister?
Well, my sister is 7 years my senior. She was always a very good student, good to the family, and she was one of the lucky women, thanks to my mother's perseverance, who received a full scholarship to what was called, at that time, Frick Teachers Training School. And it was in Oakland, where Frick's Elementary School still exists on DeSoto Street. And it was...
Frick Teachers Training School,
and it was a it was an organization, an institution that was put together through grants from the Henry Clay Frick Foundation. And what they did is they would take 15 young women a semester, 30 a year, and they would put them through 4 years of teachers training, very specialized, and at the end of which time they were very much geared to a specific course of study. In her case, she took kindergarten training, and she did teach kindergarten for many years. I think her junior year, which was about 1937, the school was closed. There are still many teachers out in the Pittsburgh market that are products of that Frick school, because they have alumni meetings. And my sister then finished up at Pitt, where they transferred all the remaining students. And she went to school for 4 years, absolutely full payment, which was a big boon to the family, because it would have been very difficult to send her. And then she started teaching, and when she began teaching, late 38, jobs were nil. And when she did get a job, I remember her once teaching at Davis School in Squirrel Hill. She was a permanent sub, and I think around 1940, she got $4 a day. That was the permanent sub pay. But she persisted, and she finally became, you know, regular teacher. And then, well, she got her master's degree, and she went to California with a woman named Lorraine Briskman, who was also a teacher and a graduate of that school. And she was at the Home for Crippled Children, which is now the Rehabilitation Institute. And while in California, and my sister was in her, I guess, early 30s or mid-30s, this Miss Briskman's brother flew out to help them drive back across the country, and in 3 days, my sister married him in California. None of us were at the wedding, and Lorraine Briskman flew home, gave them the car, and they honeymooned across the country, and she was married to him for almost 20 years till he died in the mid-60s. She has three children, a boy who is a deputy general counsel of Westinghouse Electric Corporation, a very good job, and two daughters, one in the Cleveland area and one here in Pittsburgh. She's been a very good, solid citizen, my sister, Annette.
Very good. You mentioned your children. We have their names. We have their birth dates. We have what they do, but not much in between. Can you tell us, first tell us a little bit about their early childhood. Where were you living then, in your early marriage, early childhood?
Well, they've had a pretty stable life as far as moving or not moving, whatever gives you stability, I don't know. Our oldest was born in Mount Lebanon when we were still living there the first couple years of our marriage.
You moved to Mount Lebanon when you were married. Mm-hmm. We lived in Mount Lebanon. Where?
We lived on Cochrane Road in an old farmhouse building that has since been destroyed right near Virginia Manor.
Okay.
And then we moved from there to Brookline for a short time in an apartment building. And then when we decided we were going to stay here a while, we bought this home in Whitehall. We've been in the same house since October 1954. Talk about not changing. My wife, who had said she had lived in 27 places or something as a child, she can never believe that we've been in this one house for 36 years, 37. Our two younger sons were both born in... Mark.
Okay.
M-A-R-K. He was about two when we moved into this house in Whitehall in October of 54, and then December 54, Stephen was born. And the youngest was born this date, June 11th, who we're talking right this minute, in 1959, and his name is Danny. And the boys have all finished school. Mark went to and was graduated from Allegheny College in Meadville. Steve started out to be a pre-dental student at Pitt, and he said the famous line when he got to organic chemistry is what separates the doctors from the patients. So he dropped out of pre-dental school and ended up in communications. And the youngest started at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and then for 2 years, then he finished at Pitt for 2 years or so. So they've all graduated undergraduate school. None of them have gone on. Mark was at one time going to go to law school, but he was married in 1974. And this is Mark, and he has three children, or three grandchildren. They live in Chicago. He has been, in the last dozen years or so, involved in the HMO field, health maintenance organizations. He's been a marketing man, vice president of marketing for a major one. He's now in the throes of starting his own business, which is allied with that in a sort of a consulting basis. The middle son, Stephen, is back in Pittsburgh at this current moment. He's put a couple of hitches in California, where he's put his toe in the show business and then pulled it out again because he used to hate it. And in between, he did many strange things, that kid. He sold cars. He was a crime photographer for the county. He was a pharmaceutical salesman. Anyhow, he's back into comedy writing. And at this moment, he's planning to move back to California because he's still on the staff of Jay Leno, who has now been named as the host for The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson retires next May. And so Steve feels although he's on Leno's staff, it's different when Leno has the show full time. He thinks he better get back out there if he wants to protect himself and his job. So he'll probably be moving back to California. The two other sons are both in Chicago. The youngest one is also in the health maintenance field with a different company than his brother, but he's in Chicago and he's engaged to be married.
That's Danny.
And he's engaged to be married.
In Chicago?
Mm-hmm. So we have two in Chicago, one currently in Pittsburgh, but only temporarily. He'll go back to California, I know.
Is he married, the middle one?
No, he's obsessed with jokes, that's all.
Okay. So. Now, when they were growing up, where did they go to school? In Whitehall?
Mm-hmm. They went to, various elementary schools. They kept changing the zone, but they went to elementary school there, and they all graduated from Baldwin Whitehall High School, and then on to college.
Mm-hmm. Did, because of the mixed marriage, what was their Jewish influence?
I don't know. It's very difficult to to actually say. I certainly know that they don't try to hide it. Their education within it is limited somewhat. They have been exposed to it. They seem to sort of delight in it, but they are not what I would call very orthodox or well-structured Jews, but I think they certainly own up to it and sort of are proud of the fact. They were very good about it. So they would go to Hanukkah and then have Christmas. They did everything. And whether it's good for them or bad for them, it's very difficult to say. I don't think deep in my heart that that's a major trauma with any of them. And I think maybe it isn't because they're all boys. I think maybe it would have been a different picture.
Were they bar mitzvah?
No.
None of them?
No.
Okay. Did you do holidays in your home?
Mm-hmm. On a limited basis, uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we still do, and they're still very aware of it. And they would go to my mother's or my sister's with me. And if they're in town, they still do. You know. It's not the easiest thing, and it's something that if you have to be very strong to accept, but I think it is possible.
Okay. Now, you have mentioned a lot of personalities last week. Can we get back to those?
Surely.
One that you said that you had wonderful feelings about and dealings with was John Heinz. Do you have anything to tell us about John Heinz personally?
Well, I guess my first activity with him was many years ago when he was just elected to Congress, which has to go back to the, I guess, very early 70s and or late 60s, and he was a very young man, but then I was too. And I remember the Rotary organization in Sharpsburg had a Rotary roast for him, and I was the roast master. So we first tangled a little bit at that time, and he got a kick out of it, and he was very quick on the comeback. And following that, he and I would meet in Washington, D.C. at congressional dinners, which I did for the Pennsylvania Broadcasters for many years, and we always sort of exchanged quips, and we sort of became friendly. And my favorite story probably about him is that one hot summer day I came home on a Friday, and it was real warm, and I walked into the house through the kitchen door, and I went right to the refrigerator and plopped a ice cube in my mouth, at which point the phone rang, and I picked it up, and I said, "Hello," and he said, "Is this David Kranz?" I said, "Is this David Kranz with a C?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, this is John Heinz." I said, "Oh, hi, Senator." He said, "I was just checking, are you coming to my picnic tomorrow?" And I said, "No." He said, "Were you invited to my picnic tomorrow?" I said, "No." He said, "If I invited you to my picnic, would you come?" I said, "Probably." He said, "Would you want to bring your wife and any of the children?" I said, "I might." He said, "You know how to get to my place?" I said, "No." And we went through all this, and then he said, "And if you do come tomorrow, would you MC the program for me?" And I said, "Sure." So I did all his picnics from that point on, every summer that he had one. Once in a while, he'd skip a summer. And then he was kind enough to invite Lucy and me to his wonderful holiday dinner at the Carnegie, at the Architectural Hall, the early part of December, that was followed by a holiday program over at the Heinz Chapel, which was then followed by a reception for more people at the Commons Room of the Cathedral. And he and Teresa, we got to know them, and it was a very limited group of people that went to his dinners. I mean, maybe 180 people. I used to always comment to my wife that we were probably the poorest ones in the room, but he used to say to me every time I came in through the reception line, "You don't have to MC tonight." And he was very kind to me, and I used to always kid him that, "Get to the White House before I get too old, because I want to MC one dinner for you."
Oh, that's beautiful.
And he used to say, okay, well, little did I know he'd go before me, but he was a very nice man, a very sincere man, and it's one of the real crimes and sadnesses of American politics, I think. So,
For the record, do you remember the date of that fatal helicopter crash? April what?
April 4,
1991.
Yeah, I remember it well because I was driving to town for a meeting and I was in the car when I heard it, and by the time I got to the William Penn Hotel and gave my car to the valet thing, it was all over.
Sad day. How about some personalities at Channel 4, like Paul Long? Wait a minute, 1 second. Oh, back to the Heinzes. Could you, for the tape, tell us where the picnics were?
Picnics were held at his Pittsburgh home, which was called Rosemont, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-T, Squaw Run Road in Fox Chapel. And it's the old family place, and I think at one time they had horses there. But I used to love it because his picnics, he would park 2,000 cars in the meadow.
Okay.
And it was, he invited everybody. He was a very good host.
Okay, thank you. Now, do you want to talk about Paul Long at all?
Paul Long. I've worked with him for some 25 years. I've known him probably for 35 or 40. He and I still work together. We go out every Tuesday with the Our Town segments for the Channel 4 News, and which I set up, and then Paul and I go out with the Juan Zanos and a camera person. But Paul is he's a real curmudgeon. He's a real character. He's a great historian. He's very bright. At this moment we're speaking, in June of 1991, he is 75 and a half years old. And he's going to get a new contract in October because he won't work without a contract. And maybe he's slowed down a little bit, but not much. And he's wonderful. I'll give you a favorite anecdote about him. On our Tuesdays, we go out and we do these Our Town visits and we talk about the highlights of various communities. On the way back, I usually have lunch with him. And this is sort of the ritual. And this one time we were in Ligonier, and he said, "We're not going to have time, Pete, because I've got to get back and do something." I said, "All right." We had a camera photographer with us. He said, "Maybe we could stop at one of those fast food places." And I said, "That's fine with me." So we got near Latrobe. I said, "Where do you want to stop?" And he said, "Well, I don't care." I said, "Is McDonald's all right?" He said, "Okay." So he started to run out of the car with $20 in his hand, and he said, "Tell me what you want, and I'll get it." And I said, "Sit down, Paul." I said, "This is one of those drive-thrus, and you can order." He looked at me like he didn't know what I was talking about. And I had just read, this was last year, that 98.2% of all Americans had eaten in McDonald's last year. And I think that I have the 2.5% who didn't in the back seat, but I couldn't believe it. When we pulled up, I said, "Just tell them through the speaker what they want." And he said he wanted two hamburgers and a beer. And I knew he had never been at McDonald's.
Well, that's wonderful.
Now he's a champion. He takes his wife there.
That's wonderful. How about some other personalities? Of course, we're interested in Nick Perry. Do you have anything to tell us about
him? Well, I knew Nick when I was still in college. I used to do a radio show on WPIT, and Nick was the staff announcer. So I go back to 1947-48 with him. And I've known Nick. And then when I went to the station, of course, he was one of our announcers. He was also doing our bowling shows. He was also doing our Dialing for Dollars movie. He was hosting a bunch of shows. And a good friend. And I went on a trip for the Pennsylvania Broadcasters to one of the islands, I don't know, with my wife. And when I came back, our middle son, Stephen, picked us up at the airport and said, "While you were gone," there was a big scandal here about the lottery being fixed, because that was produced out of WTAE Channel 4 here for the whole state. And then he got the investigation started, and as the months dragged on until September, we were in the middle of it, and I happened to be the only one at the station in an executive capacity of the morning that it all broke loose, that I guess it was Governor Thornburg at the time brought the indictment, and he was indicted along with a couple of our stagehands and one lottery official for fixing the lottery. And I would think And I can say that day that it happened was Yom Kippur, the day of Yom Kippur Eve. And I remember being at my desk at 20 after 9 in the morning when the announcement was made out of Harrisburg. It was now 6 o'clock at night, and I hadn't gotten up, and I had a half-eaten sandwich somebody had brought me. By this time, our executives, other executives, had flown back to the station, and I was sat with the lawyers and issued statements from the New York Times to the Washington Post to every major news source in the country. Was on television on all the stations and was totally exhausted. And I remember at 6:20 I stood up and thought, I can't even walk. And I think that's the only night I've ever missed Yom Kippur. I just couldn't go. But that was the day the thing broke. 6 months later, Nick was sentenced to 3 to 7 years for his crime, which he still has never acknowledged. And two of our stagehands went to jail for 1 to 3 years. They both acknowledged their part of it. It was a real mess, and it's never ended. It always keeps coming up, and it will come up forever. And Nick's a little bitter. I see him once in a while, but he's certainly no friend anymore.
So you were the public relations person. All the press releases mm-hmm. went
yeah.
through you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, I was that spokesperson that you always read about. Unnamed spokesperson.
Okay. I was it. What do you have to tell us about Mark Russell?
Well, that's a new one, because I haven't met him yet. That's going to be in August.
Oh, I see.
I'm
going to
do my first show with him.
Okay, that's August 1991.
Yes.
And what is the show?
Well, I'm going to do a program with him in Buffalo for, it's the 80th anniversary of the founding of the Buffalo Rotary Club. So I'm going to MC the program, and he's going to be the entertainer.
Right, good.
Do
you have anything to tell us about Ricky Wirtz? She had a children's program, didn't
yep,
she?
Yeah, she had a show called Ricky and Copper. I knew her from the Playhouse days. She was a student when I first went to work. W-E-R-T-Z and R-I-C-K-I. She was a student at the Pittsburgh Playhouse when I worked there, and her roommate, and they were put up at Pitt, in the dorms at Pitt, and her roommate, believe it or not, was Shirley Jones. And they both went to school together. And then, so I knew Ricky in those days. My wife did a musical with her, or a couple of musicals with her at the Playhouse. Then when I went to the station, Ricky was working there doing this children's show, Ricky and Copper. And then she worked on our morning show, which featured Hank Stoll, who was also a children's personality and adult personality, Joe Negri, the musician, myself. Nick Perry was our newscaster. And Ricky was on the show. So we worked together for a year, 5 days a week then. And I still see Ricky occasionally. She's now involved with the Chemical People program at WQED. And after she sort of laid off commercial television, she went back and got her master's, and she's into social work, and she's doing quite well.
You mentioned Harold Cohn, the critic.
Mm-hmm.
What paper was he?
He was the great, probably one and only great critic this town has ever seen up to now. He was at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette from the days of the late 20s. I think he got out of Penn State about 1927, somewhere in that period. And he was the drama editor until his death in 1969. He's been dead over 20 years, which is hard to believe. And Harold Cohn was probably the best-known movie critic in the country at one time and won all kinds of national awards from the Directors Guild and other places. A good friend of many of the stars, certainly of the local stars like Dick Powell and Gene Kelly, he was their bosom buddies. He spent a lot of time in Hollywood covering the Hollywood beat. When I first came back to Pittsburgh to work at the Pittsburgh Playhouse as their press representative, he was the first and only drama critic on a newspaper that ever asked me to sit down. I had done this in New York and in Boston and in Pittsburgh, and never forget him. He said, "Sit down, kid." And he was so kind to me, and he used a lot of the stuff I gave him, and we always chit-chatted. I made the rounds every Tuesday with all my news releases and information, feature stories. And then somewhere in the 50s, he tried to get me a job in Hollywood writing for George Gobel or Steve Allen. He was always so helpful. so nice, and I just adored the man. We did a television show together, Harold Cohn and myself, and Carl Krug, who was the drama editor of the Sun-Telegraph, on old WDTV Dumont in the early 50s. It was called Show Biz Quiz. This went on for a while. My wife did little sketches on the show. We were sponsored by Camel cigarettes. We were big time, I remember. And on that show, he was my benefactor. And that show, he got a lot of stars to come on and be our guests. Eddie Cantor was on the show, Jeff Chandler. I'm just trying to think of the stars who would come through town. I did that show with him for years, for a couple of years. And then Harold was ill in the 60s for a while. He was away from Pittsburgh. But he came back, and then he worked here, and he sort of died suddenly after all that time. His wife, we still keep in touch with. Her name was Stephanie Diamond, Pittsburgher. She's in Provincetown. She's still around, and she writes to my wife. They correspond. And she was a performer, too. She used to be a straight woman with a great old comic named Joe Penner, who was a national act. But Stephanie was in the theater at one time. But Harold, he helped so many young people, and as I say, no one was ever kinder to me than he in this business.
You mentioned last time, and also this time, that you were the escort for the stars that came through Pittsburgh. Do you have some names and some anecdotes for us?
Yes. That's escort.